Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Stephen Harrigan about his new historical novel that presents the early 20-something Abraham Lincoln as kind of a mess. Ambitious and keenly intelligent, yes, but not yet ready for primetime. He had little formal education, made all kinds of social mistakes, and spent time on things that did not seem connected to his rise to prominence, including theater, games, even writing poetry. In short, this true American hero did not start out so special. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As my guest sees it, Lincoln wasn't necessarily born to greatness. He made a conscious choice to take unprecedented positions and fight seemingly unwinnable battles. And the potential for that kind of originality may lie within all of us. Adam Grant is professor of management and psychology at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Originals: How Nonconformists Move the World. Adam, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Everybody wants to be an original thinker. How common is it that somebody is truly more likely than average to have amazing ideas and the ability to bring them to fruition?
I think most of us underestimate our own originality. We worry that either we don't have new ideas to bring to the table, or if we do, that other people are going to think they're crazy, which is why you see that across industries, when you ask people about their most important suggestion or their boldest idea, 85% of them stayed silent instead of speaking up.
So I wear glasses every waking moment of the day. And a few years ago, I discovered this company that sells really cheap frames online and lenses for a ridiculously affordable price. What does your decision not to invest in that company have to do with your interest in this subject?
Thank you for reminding me of that. I was teaching my first class at Wharton, and this student named Neil came to me and said he was planning to start a company with some friends and sell glasses online. And I just said, that sounds crazy. Who would ever order glasses over the internet? And of course, they named the company Warby Parker. They were just recognized as the world's most innovative company and valued at over $1 billion. And now my wife handles our investments. The reason that I didn't bet on Warby Parker was they didn't seem committed. They hadn't dropped out of school. They'd worked internships over the summer instead of focusing full-time on the business. They all lined up backup jobs just in case their startup didn't work out. And a day before the company launched, they still didn't have a functioning website. And I was like, guys, you realize it's an internet business. The whole company is a website. That's literally all it is. But what I didn't see at the time was that they were really trying to make sure that they got the business right. And when they lined up backup jobs, they didn't feel rushed to get a bad product to market. They wanted to make sure that they built a great brand that was sophisticated and unique. They were figuring out a way to get people to do a home try-on for free so that they would be willing to give this ordering idea a shot. And ultimately, they ended up becoming successful because of that hesitation as opposed to in spite of it.
What's interesting about Warby Parker is that they were not the first ones to sell glasses inexpensively online. They have just sort of outperformed their competitors who came before them.
Yeah, what I learned from them and from a lot of the research that followed was that to be original, you don't have to be first. You just have to be different and better. We all think we have to have a first mover advantage, that if somebody else beats you to market, you're not going to have a chance. But actually, the first mover advantage is mostly a myth. One of my favorite studies looked at 50 different product categories, hundreds and hundreds of companies, comparing the first movers that were the ones who created the market with the improvers who went and made the product better. And the first movers had a failure rate of 47% compared with only 8% for the improvers. It's really hard to create something from scratch. It's a lot easier to make somebody else's product better.
And it's obvious, especially if you write, you know, if someone else has written something, you can really polish it to perfection. It's easier than starting from the very beginning.
So much easier.
So you write that at the heart of originality is a challenge. We need to always be aware that there might be a better way to do things, which can, it sounds simple, but it can be challenging when we're focused on just producing.
Yeah, it can. I think, though, that the starting point for most of us is the opposite of déjà vu. It's called vujade. I love this term. It's basically the idea of seeing something you've seen many times before, but looking at it with fresh eyes. It's, you know, standing in line waiting for a taxi and looking around and noticing there are lots of cars driving by you with empty seats and suddenly wondering, why can't I have one of those? And then creating Uber. I think we all need to have more of those Vujardin moments where instead of just taking the world for granted as we see it and saying this is how it works, we ask, well, how could it be different? Is there a way it could be better?
How can we assess the radical risks that we might take for our brilliant ideas, knowing that ultimately there are practical limits to how many radical risks we can take before we're out of money or time or social capital wherever we work?
Yeah, I don't think that all of us need to take radical risks to be original. So if you look at entrepreneurs, compare the big risk takers who, when they have an idea, they quit their jobs to go all in on a company, with the people who are much more risk averse and say, I don't know if this business is going to work out. So I keep my day job and I start a company on the side. If I do that, I am 33% less likely to fail than if I quit and go all in. And I think that, granted, you have to take some risks, right? If you're going to do something new, you're accepting uncertainty, you have a lower probability of success than if you're doing something that's been tried and demonstrated before. But I think what you see with successful original people is that they think about risk like a portfolio, like a stock investment, where if you're going to make a really risky bet on an investment, you will go out of your way then to say, you know what, I'm going to then invest in some really safe and secure mutual funds just to make sure I don't lose everything. And there's no reason why we can't approach risk the same way and say, look, if I'm going to start a business, then I need to give myself some financial security. And I'm going to make sure also that I have some backup plans just in case.
That was a real revelation to me because the founding myths of very successful endeavors tend to edit out the fact that there might have been a plan B somewhere in the beginning.
They do. We love to tell these stories of, you know, these heroic entrepreneurs like Bill Gates who drop out of school and go for broke to start Microsoft. And we leave out the part of the story where he doesn't drop out. He takes a leave of absence so he can come back to Harvard. He is bankrolled by his parents, and he has a year of software sales under his belt. Doesn't sound so risky anymore, does it?
So experience, Adam, is something that we typically see as a benefit, right? But the more expertise we have in a particular field, the more convinced we might become that we've already learned the right way to do it.
Yeah, expertise and originality have real trade-offs. There's some fascinating evidence that expert accountants have a harder time adapting than novices to new laws and rule changes. And expert bridge players have a more difficult time adjusting when you change the rules of the game. And there's this entrenchment effect. When you become an expert, you tend to take for granted the assumptions that you should be questioning. And the great originals typically across fields are the ones who have not the deepest expertise, but the broadest perspective. You see this with fashion designers, for example, where the most original fashion designers, if you look at the data, are the ones who have spent the most time not traveling abroad, not living abroad, but working abroad in countries that are different from their own. So if you're American, it doesn't help a lot to go and take a trip to Canada. It may be good for the Canadian economy. But what you want to do is say, okay, I'm going to go spend a few months really working and collaborating with people in Eastern Europe or Latin America, where the cultural assumptions and worldviews are very different, and I'm going to start to assimilate and internalize those, and then I can bring that back to my own work.
I was interested that in terms of exercising creativity, we are better off almost having nothing to lose as a newcomer than being fairly well established but not running the show.
Yeah, the middle status conformity effect. Love this. So you do see that middle managers are more risk averse than entry-level employees at the bottom and leaders at the very top. And a lot of people think that's because risk-averse people just like being in middle manager roles, like Dwight Schrute from The Office.
Right.
But there's actually evidence that being in a middle status position can cause you to become more conservative and cautious in your thinking. Because when you're at the middle, if you bet on a risky idea, everyone's going to blame you for the failure. And you have a ways to fall, and you've worked hard to get where you are. If you're at the top, you have license to deviate. You're expected to think differently and try new things. And if you fail, it's not going to jeopardize your career because you've really built up a track record. And if you're at the bottom, you have nothing to lose. Why not be different?
So for folks who are, at least for the present time, in the middle, what do you suggest in order to shake up our thinking?
Well, there's a great experiment by a Stanford professor, Justin Berg, who wanted to know how to accomplish exactly that. And he got people to evaluate ideas and look at radical new possibilities, unusual innovations, and try to predict which ones would succeed. And middle managers were way, way risk averse. They were just focusing on all the reasons that the idea might not work, looking for excuses to reject it. He was able to disrupt that by just shifting the way that they approach the idea evaluation process. Right before they judge other people's ideas, they're asked to spend 5 minutes just generating ideas of their own. And just a few minutes brainstorming is enough to get them out of an evaluative, you know, look for the negatives mindset and into a creative, let me see the possibilities frame of mind. So I think we could probably all say, you know what, every time I evaluate new ideas, I'm going to spend a couple minutes brainstorming ideas of my own.
That's so remarkable because we've all been in a meeting with that person who's like, can't be done. We've tried this before and failed. No, we shouldn't do it.
Yeah, sadly, I think that it's easier to find reasons that new ideas are going to fail than that they're going to succeed. But do you want to be the person who rejected a TV show about nothing and passed on Seinfeld? Do you want to be all the publishers who are kicking themselves because they turned down a children's book for being too long? And I don't know about you, but last time I read a Harry Potter book, it was too short for my taste.
Right. Well, of course, there is the idea that you can use a devil's advocate in meetings, but there are ways to really put that perspective to work in a group dynamic. Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned about that?
Yeah, so groups need dissenting opinions to make good decisions and to innovate. And the way that most leaders try to navigate that is they say, I'm going to appoint a devil's advocate to challenge the majority. And it's a great idea in theory. In practice, it doesn't usually work so well. We have decades of evidence that when you assign a devil's advocate, two things happen. One, that person doesn't argue forcefully enough because, you know, it's just a role play, right? It's not taken seriously. And two, the audience knows it. It's like, well, I'm aware you're just, you know, kind of pretending to have this belief. You don't really care about it. And if you want a really effective minority opinion, you need to stop assigning devil's advocates and start unearthing them. Find the people who genuinely disagree, who hold divergent points of view, and invite them into the conversation, the silent minority. Now, a lot of leaders like that idea, but they say, wait, what if they're wrong? And I have some good news on this. Dissenting opinions are useful even when you're wrong. So if you have a group with a majority preference, you bring in somebody who genuinely disagrees with it, even if that person is incorrect, you find that the odds of the group making a good decision or innovating effectively go up. Because the divergent opinion stimulates them to say, let's re-examine our assumptions and let's bring in new information we hadn't considered before, which is good for breaking the mold.
How do you empower people to let you know that they think you're wrong, even if you've given them permission and you're trying to unearth them? If everybody else in the room, including people who outrank you, seem to espouse an idea, it can be tough to speak up.
Yeah, I think it can be extremely hard. So look, we need leaders to create a culture of psychological safety where you are punished for not speaking your mind. Elon Musk told me recently that was one of his major priorities, both at Tesla and SpaceX, is to make it literally unsafe not to speak up so that, you know, you could actually go as far as Bridgewater, the hedge fund that's done this so successfully. They have performance evaluations where one of the metrics is, are you speaking your mind, fighting for right, and bringing critical opinions to the table that will make other people better, even if they're hard to hear. And when you start to evaluate people on that, they begin to realize, if I don't do this, I can't be effective around here. And then they bring their ideas to the table. I think that, obviously, we can all get better at communicating our ideas. I think one of the mistakes we make is we tend to assume that pitching an idea once or twice is enough. But the data say that it's often 10 to 20 exposures before people really start to appreciate and become open to a new idea. Now, I'm not suggesting that you go to your boss and say, hey, you know that idea that you shot down 6 minutes ago?
Right.
Here it is again. But rather, find ways to make the idea more familiar. The Warby Parker founders did this great.
You know, I'm going to jump in here. We have to take a quick break, so I'm going to let you tell that story in just a moment. My guest is Wharton Professor Adam Grant. His new book is called Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Adam Grant, professor of management and psychology at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Adam, tell us what the Warby Parker guys did to keep their ideas alive, including their, I guess, their good ideas that they were trying to pitch.
Yeah, it was amazing. So initially they just said, we're going to try selling glasses online. And everyone had the same reaction I did, which is, yeah, I have to go into a store. I have to try them on. No way. But then they started connecting their idea to something that was familiar. And they said, we're going to try to do for glasses what Zappos did with shoes. Hmm. And all of a sudden people are like, wow, you know what? I didn't used to order shoes online either, but now I do. And then GQ ended up calling them the Netflix of eyewear.
Huh.
Which was another, you know, I used to go to Blockbuster and now I get DVDs or I just log in on my computer. And I think we could all take a moment and say, with our most original ideas, what is it about them that's similar to something that already works? Which is why so many startups are being pitched today as the Uber for X.
How can employers tell whether somebody applying for a job is, in fact, an original thinker? We're all trying so hard to impress in a job interview. How can we see through the bravado and see through to the person that we want to hire?
My favorite way to navigate this, actually, is to ask them how they would improve the interview process.
Huh.
They've just gotten a bunch of exposure to your organization, right? They've been through some of your practices and policies. And when you pose that question, you get some real information about a few things. One, you know, have they actually thought about how to improve it? Two, are they willing to speak up about it? And then three, are they able to strike a good balance between thinking outside the box and still being practical?
What does it take to recognize somebody else's original idea for what it is? You know, sometimes we love the ideas we have and we're just naturally resistant to somebody else's ideas.
Yeah, I think the most important thing, if you want to become open to other people's original ideas, is you want to stop comparing them to what's worked in the domain in the past.
Hmm.
I think, you know, there's so many people, you see this a lot with venture capitalists, where they think their intuition is really great. Steve Jobs was in this situation as well. He wanted to invest $63 million of his own money in the Segway personal transporter, which did not quite turn out to be as great as he expected. And the mistake there is to say, look, you know, my intuition has been, you know, it served me well. And so I'm just going to, you know, rely on my gut. Intuition is only reliable in a domain where you've built up a lot of experience. So in the world of software, Steve Jobs was able to say, you know, look, I've had a ton of expertise in that domain. I've seen lots of different ideas. And his unconscious mind could do pattern recognition faster and more accurately than really sitting down and doing the calculation. But moving into the world of transportation, didn't know a whole lot about that. He was no more knowledgeable than a lot of other individuals as a consumer. And so you actually have to sit down and do the rational analysis when it's a new domain. And I think a lot of us probably make the mistake of not doing that.
I don't know what it says about me that I'm not putting this question off until the very end, but it turns out that exceptionally original thinkers are often procrastinators.
Yeah, I'll tell you about that later. No, I have to say I was a little bit disturbed by this finding because I'm the opposite of a procrastinator. I'm a precrastinator. You know that panic you feel a couple hours before a big deadline when you haven't done enough?
Right.
I feel that a few months or weeks in advance. And, you know, I was proud of that for a long time. I finished my senior thesis as an undergrad 4 months early, and I felt like anything worth doing was worth doing ahead of schedule. But then I had a student named Jihei who did a bunch of research and showed that procrastinators, both in companies and in experiments, were more creative than people like me who rushed in and finished things ahead. Procrastination is great for incubation. It lets ideas germinate. It's also really good for divergent thinking. It encourages you to make, you know, unexpected connections and random leaps as opposed to just like following a linear path. And I found that some of the great originals in history were serious procrastinators. Da Vinci, he spent 16 years working on and off on the Mona Lisa, and he felt like a failure. He wrote as much in his journal. But some of the diversions he took when he got distracted from painting, like experiments in optics, led him to new ways of modeling light as a painter and helped him become the Renaissance man. So procrastination worked for Da Vinci. It probably could work for the rest of us, too.
of course, Da Vinci was not like binge watching Orange is the New Black, right? He was doing things that contributed to his creativity.
He didn't know that at the time, though. Huh. So strangely, he didn't return my request for interviews. But, you know, I can imagine that those are the kinds of things he would have done if he were here today. He was, you know, he was so curious. He was constantly, you know, like following the next shiny object that ran into his path. And some of those things were not productive. His design of a flying machine, you know, didn't exactly take off. No pun intended. But, you know, you see this with a lot of great originals. Aaron Sorkin, the screenwriter, he was once interviewed and asked, you know, how do you live with yourself when, you know, you sometimes it's time to film a show and you still have not finished the script? And he says, you call it procrastinating? I call it thinking. We all need a little bit of thinking time. And what you see with great originals is that often they are quick to start but slow to finish. So they'll begin a project early, they'll take some initiative to try to come up with new ideas, but they will purposely delay the completion of the idea to make sure they've given it enough time to really develop.
It's a nice reminder that highly original thinkers come up with a lot of duds along with their brilliant ideas. It's just that the less great stuff doesn't necessarily remain in the popular memory.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Successful originals have more bad ideas than their peers. And, you know, I always thought if you're going to be a creative genius, then, you know, you just dream up these masterpieces. But no, what you see is that in every domain, the greatest originals are the ones who produce the most volume of work, which gave them more variety and a chance to stumble on a few things that were truly new. Look at classical composers, for example. One of the best predictors of how many pages they get in an encyclopedia, how much experts think their music is extraordinary, is basically how many compositions they've generated. You see even the greats, Beethoven, Bach, Mozart, to come up with a relatively small number of masterpieces generated over 600 compositions each. And, you know, there are a lot of duds along the way. Shakespeare, the same time he was working on Hamlet and Macbeth, worked on Timon of Athens and Merry Wives of Windsor, both of which have been panned by critics. And, you know, if they can churn out average work, so too can the rest of us.
Do originals process their failures in any special way?
Yeah, I think what I found striking was I sat down with a lot of the most compelling originals of our time. I spoke with Jack Dorsey from Twitter, Elon Musk, Larry Page, Google, and wanted to know, one thing was, are they afraid of failing? You know, they just seem to be so confident and sure of their ideas. But we only hear from them when they're done and they know their idea is going to succeed. Along the way, a lot of these originals describe feeling the same fear of failure as the rest of us. Right? No one wants to see their idea bomb. But they are even more afraid of failing to try. Hmm. They note in the long run that our biggest regrets are not our actions, but our inactions. The chances that we didn't take. Those are the things we wish we could do over. And so what they remind themselves of is, look, you know, you could fail by, you know, creating a business that goes bankrupt, but you could also fail by never starting a business at all. And, you know, that fear of failing to matter overwhelms the fear of failing.
Passion seems to be a unifying theme here as well. I mean, you know, people have different things that really motivate them, but it's really hard to be the best in the world at something you don't care that much about.
It does. Yeah, it's, you know, it's hard to imagine investing in an idea if you're not passionate about it. But if you look at the evidence, passion is just as often a result of effort as a cause. Hmm. It's this great study by Michael Frazier and his colleagues where they track entrepreneurs over the course of developing their business ideas. And sure enough, when you're passionate one week, you put in more effort the next week. But you also see that the more effort you put in, the more passionate you become. Because you end up developing more expertise. It's hard to love something when you're not any good at it. And you also start to make progress and feel like, you know, this might actually amount to something, which, you know, sort of stokes your enthusiasm. So I think sometimes we should remember when we don't feel that passion initially, it's because we haven't put in the time required to be able to do something worthwhile.
Why is it that certain periods of our lives, our professional lives, tend to be more richly creative than others? And are there things that you can tell us that will sort of tide us over when we don't feel like we're getting a lot of home runs?
Yeah, volume of output is such a huge factor here. So like we talked about earlier, If you look at people's careers, the points where they have the most original ideas are the times when they're just producing the most volume. Thomas Edison, if you track his career in five-year increments, what you'll see is the burst where he pioneered the light bulb and did some of his most original work was also the time where he had the most duds of patents that went nowhere. He right around that time, he tried to create a talking doll that was so creepy that it scared not only kids but adults too.
Right.
He was trying to mine iron ore with magnets. That didn't work out. He was creating a fruit preservation technique that failed miserably. And I think we just have to try more ideas. Now, a lot of people will say, but after my first few ideas, I either fall in love with one and I stop, or I generate 15 ideas and I'm just out of steam. There's some great research out of Northwestern that just looked at this, where people generated 15 ideas, they thought they had nothing left, and the researchers just gave them a little nudge and said, you know, you got a few more minutes, why don't you brainstorm and see if you can come up with a few more? People were able to come up with 20 more ideas on average, even though they thought they had nothing left. Those 20 ideas were more original than their first 15, because your first ideas are usually the most obvious. That's why they were easy to think of. And so I think the lesson here is that the moment you feel like you're out of ideas is the moment when you are ready to start being original.
I was really interested in this. You cite a statistic that vegans are 3 times more likely to hold prejudice toward vegetarians as vice versa, because vegans see vegetarians as like, you know, posers or wannabes. How do small differences among people who ostensibly have really similar goals affect their ability to work together successfully?
Well, Freud wrote about this. I think it was one of his only good ideas, but he wrote about the narcissism of small differences. And the basic idea is that we think that having common goals is going to bring us together, but oftentimes it drives us apart because extreme groups often look down their noses at more mainstream groups as not serious, as sellouts. So vegans look at vegetarians and say, you know, you're not really committed to this cause. And they actually hate vegetarians on average more than they dislike meat eaters because they're impure and they're, you know, they're not standing up for the principles that vegans believe in. And I think that, you know, it's really easy to say, well, if only we could see that we're really after the same thing, we should all get along. But it's more likely that if you look at the data, groups will end up forming alliances and coalitions, not because they share the same goals, but because they have the same means. They use similar working methods, they have similar technologies, and that makes it easy for them to collaborate.
Any thoughts on extrapolating those ideas to what we're seeing in politics these days?
No.
Pass?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Well, let me move on to this. You write that our best allies are not the people who have supported us all along. They're the ones that that started out against us, who then come around to our side. How is that?
Yeah. So a lot of us avoid our enemies when we're pitching new ideas because we don't exactly expect them to cheerlead for us. And yeah, there are plenty of people who don't have our backs, who we've had bad relationships with before. But the fascinating thing about this is the people that we end up liking the most are not the people we liked all along. They're the people we started out disliking and then changed our opinions of. Because you have a lot of cognitive dissonance to overcome if you're like, wow, I thought this person was horrible, but actually it turned out to be really great. You have to work really hard to convince yourself of that. And so you become a much more devoted ally at that point. So if you can convert an enemy, right, that person will often be a really loyal advocate for you. And then also more credible. They can say, you know, I used to hate you too, but, you know, here's how I've seen the light.
You have an example in the book of a guy who made millions of dollars by starting his presentation to potential funders with the reasons they should not invest in his projects. How in the world did that go down?
Oh, I was stunned by this one. So Rufus Griscom goes and pitches to investors. He's starting a parenting website called Babbel. And he literally says, here are 3 reasons you should not invest in my company. And he walks away with over $3 million in funding that year. And, you know, part of it is it's attention grabbing, right? You don't see that very often. And you're used to being, you know, just given these extraordinarily enthusiastic pitches as an investor. But there are 2 things that I think this does that are effective. One is that he shows that he's balanced and self-critical, that he's not just snowed by his own ideas and he's able to take a serious, honest look at what's wrong as well as what's right. Two, he makes it harder for investors to think of their own objections. He names those three things, and these investors are sitting in the room thinking, you know, I had four big concerns. This guy already anticipated three of them. He must be pretty smart. So I can't show him how brilliant I am by, you know, criticizing things he already knows about. Instead, I'm going to give him some really great solutions to his problems. And then I end up convincing myself that he's somebody I want to invest in.
Yeah, it's fascinating because it really flies in the face of this idea that in order to evangelize for something that you care about, you have to just, you know, present positive after positive after positive. It does tend to cause people to wonder, you know, you start to sit there listening to this presentation and wondering, okay, what am I not hearing?
Exactly. And we were all trained when we did debate or critical writing to address counterarguments, but we forget to do that when we're pitching ideas.
Do you think people are afraid that if they bring it up, then it's going to be real and then nobody else, you know, otherwise would have considered it?
Yeah, it's so funny. I see this all the time in the research world where you do a scientific project and you go to publish it and you're supposed to write a limitation section. And oftentimes, graduate students and young professors skip the limitation section.
There were none.
And as an editor and reviewer, I always write back and say, you know, it would be really useful for you to acknowledge what's wrong with your study. Every study is flawed, and your job is to show us that the contributions outweigh the limitations. And most often, the answer I hear is, well, I was afraid if I mentioned this that, you know, reviewers would reject the paper because they would realize it's flawed. Like, look, everyone's going to see the limitations anyway if they're experts in your field. You might as well admit them and, you know, call out the elephant in the room.
Adam Grant is my guest. He's professor of management and psychology at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Adam Grant of the Wharton School. His new book is called Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Adam, what is the difference between conceptual innovators and experimental innovators?
Well, this is basically the distinction between young geniuses and old masters. There's some cool research out of Chicago on this showing that there are kind of two life cycles of creativity where some people peak early and others are able to be original much later in their lives. And it seems to be a difference in how they approach generating ideas and thinking about problems. So the conceptual innovators are the young geniuses. They're the people who basically approach a domain and have a eureka moment. And that's easiest to do when you're new to the domain and you're just starting to accumulate some knowledge about it, because you don't take for granted all the things that other people believe to be true but are wrong or incomplete. The old masters who are able to maintain their creativity are much more likely, instead of, you know, looking at the world and coming up with a grand idea, to run experiments, to test out with different styles and approaches. And they actually are able to keep learning and evolving their worldviews as they age and gain experience. Mark Twain was a great example of this. He said that he wrote Huckleberry Finn without knowing where it was going to go and was able to make that a much more original novel than if he had set out with a plan in advance, because he probably would have written it in the same way that he had written other stories before.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Saheed in Louisville. Hi, Saheed.
Hi, Chris. Always a thoughtful working program. The question I have is about, you know, people speaking up about their ideas freely, and, you know, in the age of, you know, information out there for everybody to actually go and grab and run with it. So what is the potential of somebody speaking up, and people might be afraid of speaking up about ideas because of this reason? Thank you.
So you don't want somebody to steal your idea. Is that what you're saying, Saheed?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you know, I think, look, idea theft happens. There's a lot of research showing that knowledge hoarding is common in organizations when people won't share because they're afraid somebody else is going to get credit. I think in general, those fears are overblown, because if you only have one great idea, chances are you're not going to be that original anyway, right? You need lots of ideas in order for one to hit. And so, you know, as you share them, the chances that, you know, somebody else will steal them, one, are relatively low, and two, even if they do, you should have lots of others available to you. I think the other thing is, if you don't share your ideas, you're never going to get support for them, right? Whether you're looking for people to work with you, allies, investors, you have to, at some point, be willing to voice them. I think it's reasonable in some cases to start working out an idea before you voice it, to make sure that you've, you know, really given it a chance to develop, and that, you know, it's not so easy for somebody to duplicate your effort. But I think those fears are probably more widespread than they should be.
How does birth order contribute to the tendency to be more or less original?
This is extremely controversial. It's one of the most inconsistent and conflicting bodies of research out there. But there are a series of studies suggesting that later-borns tend to be more likely to challenge the status quo than firstborns. You see that in baseball, when you study all the brothers who have ever played Major League Baseball, the ones who are the lastborn or the younger sibling are significantly more likely to attempt to and succeed in stealing a base, which is a marker of risk-taking. There's evidence that later-born scientists are more likely to champion revolutionary theories and to get on board with those theories, whereas firstborns tend to defend conventional existing views. And I even found that the most original comedians in America were significantly more likely to be last than firstborn.
I know Stephen Colbert is the last of a whole bunch of children.
Yeah, that may not be a coincidence.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. It's hard to consider a subject like this, Adam, without thinking about the importance of raising the next generation of originals. You suggest that parents can nurture the impulse to be original to a point, but then ultimately we end up limiting our own influence.
Yeah, originality is easier to thwart than it is to nurture. So what you see is the parents who raise really original kids, they tend to focus more on values than rules. I'm terrible at this. So, you know, every time our kids misbehave, I hear myself saying, "New rule!" And then
right,
not enforcing it. What, you know, rules basically lead kids to think about constraints and following, you know, other people's authority as opposed to thinking for themselves. What the parents do really well who end up with children who do great creative things in the world is they talk a lot about their values and they model them too. They engage their kids in dialogue about things like, you know, excellence is important in this family. What does success mean to you? Or we care a lot about the impact of our behaviors on others. What, you know, what kind of mark do you want to make on the people around you? And that leads kids to think a lot about the why behind their behavior, to internalize and endorse these values as their own, as opposed to just following rules because I didn't want to get in trouble. And when they grow up, then they're much more likely to really say, look, you know, other people may think my ideas are a little bit crazy, but these are my values and I'm going to stand up for them. And the irony there is that when, you know, when parents do that well, they do limit their influence because children are basically marching to the beat of their own drummer a little bit. But you've had a hand in shaping, you know, what those principles are. You just don't know exactly where they're going to take your kids.
I thought this was really interesting. There's so much talk these days about, you know, praising effort rather than assigning characteristics to a child with the way you praise or discipline. But, for example, in building the identities of younger people, it may be better to say don't be a cheater than to say, you know, to command do not cheat.
Yeah, you know, I think the message here should actually be it's problematic to praise intelligence. That we know. Carol Dweck has done this extraordinary research showing that over and over again, that when you praise kids for, you know, being smart, that when they come upon a task that's hard or that they struggle at, they give up because they say, well, I just don't have the aptitude for that. And you teach them that ability is fixed. But that does not need to be the case in the domain of character. There's a bunch of evidence that if you want kids to stop cheating, instead of saying don't cheat, you tell them don't be a cheater. You literally cut cheating in half. Preschoolers even, if you want them to help you, instead of saying will you help, you say will you be a helper?
Hmm.
And you get a 22% to 29% increase in the rate of helping. And that's because the behavior now casts a shadow, right? Like I can cheat and still think I'm a good person. But being a cheater, well, I don't want to carry that around with me. And similarly, I want to earn the identity and the image as a helper. So I think that, you know, in the domain of character, whether it's, you know, praising, you know, I guess in the domain of creativity specifically, one of the things you can say is instead of, you know, wow, that's a really creative piece of art. Wow, you are really creative.
Hmm.
And then that's a sense of self that they start to carry around with them. Teenagers, if you're worried that they're going to end up being sheep and doing things that are not exactly safe or appropriate, then instead of saying, you know, you don't have to follow the crowd, you can say you are a nonconformist, right? And have that dialogue about what those principles are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Matt in Bedford. Hello, Matt.
Hey, how are y'all doing today?
Very well, thanks.
I really appreciate this conversation and, in giving me a little bit of room and some space to procrastinate that so much fits my personality. You know, one of the things I'm kind of wondering about is how is it that originals can thrive in sometimes rigid corporate environments?
Interesting question.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a good answer to that. I think the most important thing in those environments is to pick a different group of supporters for your ideas. Most of us, when we have a new idea, we go to our most agreeable friends. The friendly, welcoming, nice, polite people we know, because we know they'll have our backs. And they do in that conversation. The problem is agreeable people tend to really dislike conflict and really shy away from rocking the boat. And that means they don't always go to bat for us. Disagreeable people, who tend to be more critical, skeptical, and challenging, are much more likely to enjoy conflict, and they will, you know, they'll probably tear your idea apart, right, in the service of making it better. And then if you can convince them that your idea has merit or you can improve it to their satisfaction, they will run through walls for you. And I think we could all do a better job seeking out those, you know, Google programmer described them once as people with a bad user interface but a great operating system. And seeking those people out, they are sometimes our best allies, even though they seem, you know, critical and grumpy on the surface.
All right. Score one for the disagreeable. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Scott on the line in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
My question is basically, in a world where we're taught not to rock the boat and originality, what do you feel it takes for an idea to be considered original, and what is attractive about originality and uniqueness?
Well, I think that if no one is original, then the world stands still, right? Original is because they speak out and stand up, because they take initiative to question the world around them. They're the people who drive creativity and change in the world. Now, you could say if everyone's an original, will anything ever get done? I think everyone could be an original in a domain, right? But all leaders need followers. All pioneers need settlers. If you're going to start a movement, you need people to get on board. What I think is dangerous is conformity. Conformity is saying, I don't agree with you. I think your idea is not correct, but I'm going to go along anyway because I want to fit in. And I think we could probably, in those moments, say, you know, there's always a choice between fitting in and standing out, and sometimes it's better to stand out.
Are originals more likely to be open to other people's ideas?
Sometimes. I think a lot of that depends on where they stand on a personality trait called openness, mm-hmm. surprisingly. So people who are highly open-minded tend to really enjoy embracing new worldviews and looking at things from fresh perspectives. They're also more likely to feel what are called aesthetic chills, which are those shivers or goosebumps you get when you're appreciating beautiful art or music or poetry. And, you know, if you look at originals who are really open-minded, and in fact, originals are more likely to be open-minded, yeah, they tend to be much more receptive to other people's ideas. But there are plenty of originals who go against the grain by saying, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. let's make sure that we, you know, we really defend important institutions that other people are trying to you know, get rid of. They tend to be less open to other people's new ideas and a little bit harder to persuade, I would say.
Companies spend a lot of time and energy trying to ensure that new hires will fit within the organization, right? We talk about a cultural fit. You say there might be a better attribute to focus on.
Yeah, most of the leaders I work with will say that cultural fit is the most important thing they do when they hire. And if you're a startup, it tends to work out pretty well in the sense that startup founders who hire on cultural fit rather than on skills or potential as the primary focus, they're less likely to fail and they're more likely to go public. But then after that, they grow at slower rates. And the danger here is that when you hire on fit, you're basically looking for a bunch of people who tend to see the world in similar ways. And you increase your risk of groupthink, which is, you know, more and more dangerous as your organization gets bigger. And instead of cultural fit, I think we could probably advocate for what IDEO does, the design firm. They say we want cultural contribution. So instead of hiring people who are going to replicate our values and bring in exactly what's already in the culture, cultural contribution is saying, let's figure out what's missing in the culture and prioritize that. And it's not just hiring, right? It's performance evaluations, bonuses, promotions, rewarding people who enrich the culture and improve it as opposed to just cloning it.
It's sort of between the lines in this book rather than really explicitly dealt with. But do you have any thoughts for how we can be better at accepting criticism in a constructive way? It's one thing to give criticism in a constructive way, but it can still be taken in a way that feels really, you know, eviscerating.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you from personal experience, the best thing that I have done is receiving criticism in public rather than private.
Huh.
So the way that this played out for me was I was teaching a very early class at the beginning of my career. And a month in, I gave out feedback forms, like most teachers do. And when I collected the feedback, I decided I was going to email all the comments verbatim to the entire class and then devote a class session to discussing it. And some of my senior colleagues said that was insane because, you know, the students were going to see that all of their peers had the same concerns they did and, you know, they were like going to have a mutiny. But I felt like it was the best way to learn was, you know, to really give them all the feedback and then have a discussion about how we could address it. And what I discovered was when I came into the next class session and said, here are the five major themes that I think came out. Here are the things that, you know, I think we could do about it. Being on stage addressing that feedback forced me to be open to it.
Wow.
If I had listened to it in private, it would have been very easy for me to get defensive. But because everyone was watching me, I was being evaluated not just on, you know, was the class good, but also was I going to listen and take their comments seriously? I'm not going to say that everyone should invite, you know, the 100 people that they know in their lives and work with to criticize them out loud in the same room. But I do think sometimes gathering a group of people that you respect and asking them all for constructive criticism really gets you in the mode of saying, how can I learn from these people?
Adam Grant is professor of management and psychology at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. Adam, thanks so much for making time for us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.